Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
And Peter's kicking himself in the behind because in producing the program we had a little hitch, but we can recover.
Yes, of course.
just as diners of the world can be expected to recover, diners and travelers of the world, you are, of course, listening to On the Menu Radio with Ann and Peter Haig. Welcome to our program, as usual, this morning. And we hope wherever you are, you're having a wonderful time, just as we were. And we're finalizing the information obtained on our recent visit to New Orleans over the Christmas holidays, and no interview about New Orleans dining and food scene can be complete without the wonderful personality John False, and you'll know why John's so well known, so famous, and such a wonderful guest as you listen to the next two interview segments.
I love John False. Well, we never run out of something to talk to John False about. It's so good seeing you again, John.
Well, it's absolutely fabulous to have you here as a guest in our Bittersweet Plantation in Donaldsonville, Louisiana. And we're always on the phone. Now I have you in person.
Yeah.
What a great treat to have both of you here. Thanks.
Well, tell us a little bit about where we are, because this place is so delightful.
Well, Bittersweet Plantation is what's referred to as an overseer's Creole cottage, basically, and it's located about 70 miles west of the city of New Orleans. We're between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, and one of the small Louisiana towns that was once the capital of the state of Louisiana, Donaldsonville, named after William Donaldson, who was an Englishman, actually, who came here and designed the plan of this city in the late 1700s, early 1800s. It was a river port town. The Mississippi River runs right through it. It's a deep water port here. And, of course, it was a center of commerce in the 1800s, being located between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And the builder of this house, Andrew Gingrey, arrived here in the 1840s to seek his fortune in the South. He had a great general merchandise store. If you wanted passage to Europe on a passenger ship, you could buy a ticket here at his home.
Wow.
at Bittersweet. You're sitting in what was his office, or the post office, in 1840. People would come to get their mail here. He was also the mayor of the city at one point, so this would have been the mayor's office. And so we're sitting in his library and office. But my wife and I restored the home. It had been in her family since the building of it in 1840, and we bought it from the family, totally restored it, moved in about 1980, and lived here for over 20 years as our home turning it into a bed and breakfast so everybody else could come, as I say, come home and stay the night.
Oh, it is so it's really homey.
It's a beautiful place. All the rooms are 20 by 20, 14-foot ceilings. As you can see, the windows are 10 feet high and 4 feet wide and go into the ceiling to make a nice open door to the front porch. Very Southern, very lovely, and we just absolutely love it. It's beautifully decorated during the Christmas holidays and different seasons of the year. We love it here. In fact, sometimes I wish I'd have never moved out into another home.
Now, you're going to be expanding, actually. Right now you have two main suites. Is that it?
I do. I have two main suites in the home.
Yeah.
One was my bedroom, my wife and I's bedroom when we lived here, the big one.
We're in Sweet Olive.
You're in Sweet Olive.
Yeah.
And Sweet Olive was is the smaller of the suites. And I will be expanding. I've purchased a few buildings here because, as you can see from the town, being one of the old river towns of Louisiana, of course, it suffered tremendously during economic times and with interstates bypassing these small southern villages.
And the refineries
coming in, and the economy changing from agricultural to petrochemical, and most of the technical people having to be brought in. Farm workers were a little bit hard to train. So anyway, to make a long story short, the town has deteriorated tremendously, as so many of these small towns do. So my goal was to come in, invest here, buy four or five of the historic buildings, build my food manufacturing plant here, and try my best to hire about 200 or 300 of these folks and put them to work. And that's what we've done. And I will be expanding. outstanding. In fact, I have a house going in right back here now with three suites, just beautiful right. suites, right on the garden, so they're going to be lovely. I hope they have 10 rooms eventually, and that's it. I don't want any more than 10, but that's...
Yeah, you might lose some of that, but it is an oasis, this place.
It's very special. If you've walked out into the gardens in the back, you know that we grow a lot of our own herbs and fruit trees here. The jellies and jams on the table all come from our gardens. Yeah,
we had plum jelly.
Persimmon.
Persimmon. And let's talk a little bit about the food. You have a restaurant. Now, people can come here without staying here, or they can stay here and have...
We primarily tried to feed our guests here. Yes. We want it to be a special place where you come and it's your home for the night. We have a staff here. Jackie is our chef who's been here for 15 years, trained under me at my Lafitte's Landing restaurant. And then Terry Sue is the manager and waiter here. Terry Sue, great Southern girl. But anyway, we try primarily to service our guests, spend the night, have dinner, have breakfast, the Planter's breakfast, but we open for special groups of six or more for private dining as well. You cannot just walk up to the front door and ring the bell and come on in and have dinner. Everything has to be pre-planned.
Oh, sure. And it's just wonderful. I mean, there's not a detail overlooked. We walked in and there's fruit and cheese in the room, and we'll talk about that cheese later. just every amenity imaginable. Dinner was delightful, romantic. Tell us, though, this a lot. You know we travel all the time.
Sure,
and all
sure.
kinds of places, but this breakfast was knock your socks off. Tell us about Planter's breakfast.
Well, the Planter's breakfast was designed, I wish I could say, through the genius of my own mind, but in fact, there's a little plagiarism going on there because, as you know, I love history and I love to.
And you're a walking encyclopedia.
Well, I love to preserve history. And promote all great historical facts on the South, but I discovered a journal from one of the fabulous, one of the most renowned of the plantation owners, Val Curaim, and Val Curaim was a Frenchman who built a home here on 7,000 acres called La Petite Versailles. And the name implies exactly what the building looked like. And of course, there was no money, not enough money could be spent at Petite Versailles when he was building it. Gardens.
How did he make his money?
In sugar. Sugar was crystallized in Louisiana in 1797, which gave birth to the golden age, or as we call it, white gold, crystallized sugar. And it made more millionaires out of planters in this area than all millionaires combined in the United States at that time in the 1800s. So you can imagine how wealthy this area is. And, of course, Val Curaim was just in the middle of all of that. In fact, he built Jefferson College, the first college here, staffed by teachers from West Point to make sure that his sons and other planter sons didn't have to go to Europe to train. He was Catholic and built two or three of the great cathedrals in this area and brought all the great artwork from France. So you can imagine how wealthy he was. But in discovering one of his journals, there was a French count who had come to look at some of the lands that were owned by the French. In South Louisiana, and this count spent the night, a week or so at his home, and he wrote in his journal that he wanted to prepare a perfect breakfast for this gentleman to kind of portray what a planter would eat after working in the fields from 4 o'clock in the morning to 10, which is when they would come in from the hot sun to eat, and of course, he created this breakfast, eggs a la creme, a good scrambled eggs with crawfish and Cajun caviar, the eggs of the bowfish.
This was the first course, listen.
Yeah, that was the first course.
After the biscuits. Now, the biscuits were the best biscuits I've ever had in my life.
Well, everyone says that our biscuits are, they're incomparable. I mean,
they are.
I've had some of the greatest, Michael Batterbury with Food Arts Magazine was in from New York, staying here a few weeks ago and said, my God, I have never had a biscuit of this
type. What is the secret? Lots of butter?
Well, it's what we call in the South as an old cathead biscuit because they're kind of big and unformed. Yours were cut out, but we normally just break a piece of dough and kind of form it and put it on the tray so it kind of gnarly as it bakes and it kind of looks like a little cat's head basically. That's why they got the name. 50% butter and 50% shortening. And of course, in old days, we use lard, right? And you cannot work the dough. You have to just mix the baking powder with the flour. But once you put that shortening in and you crumble it in to create that little sandy finish, that's it. You cannot work it anymore. And that's what gives it that fabulous flakiness that's called a Southern biscuit. But that biscuit was also designed in the 1800s, and we serve it here with our jams and jellies out of the garden. And then, of course, you had the grits and griots, and the griots is...
But you skipped over the first course a little bit. I mean, what's that called again?
The eggs a la crème.
Okay.
And
that has no calories either.
Well, what makes it kind of rich is that we scramble eggs, and then we put a little cream sauce into it to fluff them up.
Yeah,
and then we saute the crawfish tails with green onions and scallions. Uh-huh. I mean shallots. And saute that around, and then we fluff those eggs after we put the crawfish in it. They put a little, because crawfish was always served in eggs a la crème. And then right on the top, we put a little teaspoon of the cream, and then the Cajun caviar, which is salted eggs of the bowfin fish, which is a spoonbill fish of Louisiana's bayous. And, I would say it's a pretty interesting first course.
Absolutely amazing. And then we moved on, of course, to the main course.
The main course is probably the most famous dish of early New Orleans. In fact, we think it was the origin of brunch. It was created by the first woman restaurateur in, to our knowledge, probably in the country, but certainly in New Orleans, Madame Biguet. And Madame Biguet was the wife of Hippolyte Biguet, a German butcher.
What a wonderful name.
And, Madame Biguet. And she opened a little restaurant right across from the market in New Orleans, the farmer's market. The butchers would go to work at 2 o'clock in the morning. And by 9, they had put in their full day's work. And Hippolyte had Madame Biguet, his wife, open a little restaurant to serve them what he referred to as the second breakfast, because they would have eaten a 2 o'clock breakfast, and then at 9 or 10 in the morning, they would have their second breakfast, and the main dish on the table was griots. And griots was little thin strips of meat, scallopini. It could be pork, it could be veal, it could be beef, pounded out lightly, pan fried, or as we call, say in Louisiana, panade veal, and then a rich gravy, either roux-based with a little tomato, or to just bathe and simmer or braise that little cutlet in the gravy. Later we added olives to it for the Spanish-style griots, and it was always cooked for about 2 to 3 hours, and of course the butchers would supply the meat from the market for Madame Biguet to cook. And then she would serve that over stone ground grits, the yellow stone ground grits, I bought an old grits mill here, and we grind our own grits.
You're kidding.
I'm trying to do what Val Karim did. He taught us well, so I figure if you're going to sit at my table, I want everything to hit the table to come off of my plantation, right?
Well, I think that you could give a good course in the diversity of grits. I mean, Peter used to hate grits because he always found himself eating that white cream of wheat kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but this is, it's so flavorful.
Madame Biguet would actually take her heavy cast iron pots and render a little bacon. And of course, smoking it. She'd put one or two little pieces of fresh cayenne pepper into it. And then into that, she would add onion, celery, bell pepper, garlic, and fresh tomato and simmer all of that down until it cooked down into the bacon fat. Then the Yellowstone ground grits were added and stirred into that wonderful mash at the bottom of the pot. And then water added to it. So the grits picked up all of that wonderful bacon flavor and grits and onions and all of that. And it was always finished naturally. We're in Louisiana with a little bit heavy whipping cream at the end. And that's what, Peter, I hate to tell you this, but this is what makes it so good.
What about dessert?
Oh, then when did you ever have dessert for breakfast? I never even heard of that.
Well, no respectable Southern plantation owner would insult his guests by finishing with just an entree. I mean, you had to come back through and add something sweet for the finish. In fact, there was an old French saying, I'll say it in English, no matter what, you must put the lipstick on it. And the lipstick on the breakfast is the pain perdu, the lost bread,
lost
the pain perdu.
It's French, isn't it? French
what is it? It's the origin of French toast here.
Right.
And we would use the crusty leftover French bread, and the difference is we make a fabulous cooked cream custard, just like you would a creme anglaise. You eggs, milk, vanilla, sugar, cinnamon, nutmeg, allspice, and you create this wonder. You could cook it and it'd be a creme brulee. But we dip we dip the bread in it, and then we pan fry it in butter. And of course, as you know, we have a dairy, so we churn our own butter here. 82% butter fat, Peter.
Oh, the butter is also incredible.
and so we saute the bread in our bittersweet plantation butter, and then of course we top it with fresh berries in season that we cook in champagne. So we put the fruit in the skillet and toss it around for a minute. Put champagne into it, and it makes a very light champagne simple syrup that goes on top of the pain perdu, and that's the finish to the meal, and that's
and
also
the berries.
From Baucara and the berries, of course, and then in season we grow our raspberries, blackberries, plums, and all, and we like to put all of those different fruits of the season in on top of the pain perdu. So I tell people all the time, if you're going to skip anything, skip the middle course or just take a bite of the griots, but do not miss the pain perdu, because that's the lipstick on the lady. Huh?
Well, I mean, it was an experience, and I think that it's worth every calorie, and I don't even want to know how many calories. Thank you.
Well, I tell every guest here, diet on your rations and splurge on mine.
John, we were at the old Lafitte's Landing, the original cottage, which unfortunately burned to the ground. And at the time, you were just starting. I mean, you already had done your dinner in Russia, and, you know, you were a TV celebrity and so forth and so on. But you were just starting your gumbo production. Since then, you've expanded. Could you just give us an overview of, can I call it the John Fulce Empire?
Well, don't forget
all the 10 million cookbooks that weigh 12 pounds a piece.
Well, Ann, I think empire kind of suggests that you have money, and I certainly don't. So my holdings, I guess
holdings,
I should say.
Okay.
Well, I started off, as you know, with Lafitte's Landing Restaurant in 1978, a beautiful cottage, the oldest,
the
oldest Acadian plantation home standing on the river in Donaldsonville. I actually returned here after being in the hotel business for a while and returned to the place where I was born and reared, and opened a restaurant here. That was my first restaurant that I owned on my own, and that was 78. And you did have an opportunity to eat there, and unfortunately in 1998 on a Sunday afternoon, we think due to a smoldering cigarette, which thank God we have no smoking in restaurants anymore, and had we not had any then, that 1797 Acadian plantation home would still be standing. But we know that a young training waiter dumped an ashtray into a tablecloth and balled it up and threw it into a linen bin. And, of course, 250 years of Louisiana history disappeared that night in the fire. But we were lucky enough to reopen at the home you're in now at Bittersweet Plantation, which is only a couple miles away from the original site in Donaldsonville. You referred to the gumbo plant. I did start prior to that. I opened White Oak Plantation, which is my antebellum plantation home in Baton Rouge. It sits on 25 acres. It's one of the old, beautiful plantation mansions of Louisiana I bought in the mid-90s.
And it's open for
catering, weddings, parties, seminars. So it's a hotel without the rooms. Basically, we offer all of those amenities. From White Oak Plantation, I opened my bakery division, which does bakery goods for Whole Foods and companies such as Starbucks, those type of coffee companies, not particularly Starbucks, but other coffee companies. We do pastries and bakery goods for many national chains. And then, of course, 7 or 8 different bread items and savories and pastries. We're making king cakes now in the season of Mardi Gras. We start king cakes. In fact, we made 20,000 king cakes for one of the large pastry companies in New Orleans just this past week.
That's a tradition.
That's another whole show is the king cake. But anyway, I opened the pastry division, and then later on, the food manufacturing division, which started out as a small one-room plant to produce gumbo for one of the companies out on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. A new casino company had opened from Las Vegas on the Gulf Coast, and they wanted authentic Louisiana gumbo. That they figured, I guess if they hit gumbo, that's all they really needed. But anyway, so we did that, and that kind of put my toe into the food manufacturing business from a chef owning a restaurant and a catering company and a bakery division. All of a sudden, I found myself making gumbo 600 gallons at a time out of my little small kitchen. And from that, of course, was born Chef John Fulce and Company Manufacturing, which is by far the largest part of my company today. In fact, this year, we're going to produce over 100 million pounds of food products for most of the companies that you see billboards along the sides of the America's interstates. If it's one of the casual chains or the fast food concepts or any of those, chances are pretty good we're making something for them.
In the back of your head is always, though, this idea of promoting products and the culture here.
Absolutely. Everything we do must kind of fit into our mission statement of preserving and promoting the cuisine and culture of Louisiana. So even in our food manufacturing, our food items will have a lot of that flavor, unless the company is specifying an Oriental sauce or something like that, which we make a lot of, Latin sauces, etc. Now the I think we have over 300 people working in manufacturing now. I just expanded my USDA division to, I'm almost at 100,000 square feet on the roof, producing 60, 70 tons of food a shift, and I operate three shifts a day. So the food plant is quite large, and then, of course, I opened my...
How did you make that jump? You just sort of explained that you did it.
Well, I think for people in my age group, I'm 60, what am I right now? 63 years old. So I think in my age group, people will understand when I say the Mr. Magoo syndrome. You just kind of walk, you just kind of step out and that girder is there for you to stand on. The younger people will not have a clue what I'm talking about. But everybody who watched Mr. Magoo knows that, you know, I wish I could say, and I tell this to young students in my culinary school at the John Fulce Culinary Institute as I travel around. I said, you know what? I said, don't start out and plan to be successful. Just go out and plan to be good at what you're doing at the moment and commit yourself and give yourself time to blossom. You don't plant a cabbage seed and all of a sudden you have a head. You have to wait a little while for it to all happen. There's no rush in anything that's good. And that's, so I wish I could say I was a great planner or I was a strategist or that I had great financial backing. I mean, I'm a single owner. I have no partners, no investors in my company. So when young chefs look at me and say, my God, how can you do it without having nine investors in this? I said, I took my time. I grew a cabbage head is what I did. As I tell my people, let's do what we do every day as good as we can do it, and remember that we're serving a public and we're serving a customer and we're dependent on them, so they're always going to be right. Let's not argue about the fact. Just fix what's wrong and move forward, and here we are today. My dairy division, of course, opened with my cheeses, and so now we have our triple cream cheeses out in the marketplace, yogurts. I have a brand new cottage cheese that's just absolutely phenomenal.
Cottage cheese
that's an artisanal cottage cheese. In the style that came from the cottage industry of England back in the 1700s, 1800s.
And that's why it's called cottage cheese.
That's why it's called cottage cheese. And it is unlike anything on the market because I cooked the cream in the cottage cheese rather than putting a sour cream coating on top of some tough curds. I have very soft, small curds that with a cooked sweet cream on top of it. So it's almost like eating dessert. I'll have to make sure you taste some. Everything we do is like that. And of course,
there is this background of dairy. We never knew about until Peter interviewed you about operation.
Absolutely. A big dairy state here with the Germans and the Italians. But you know what, Anna? I think the secret to everybody's success ultimately will be surrounding yourself with good people, people who care, and people who you can get at some point in time to – grab the vision and implement. I mean, I can have all the great thoughts in the world, but I need those implementers who can make it happen. And little by little, you see the fire in their eyes, and you know they're going to be wonderful, and you know what they want for themselves and their families. And they're the people who build your companies. And I'll never forget that. It's the people in our company who builds it, and I'm just a guy smiling in front of the camera, you know, and I make sure they know that.
Okay, and the camera, of course, in addition to your dairy operation, your big food manufacturing, you write books. I mean, some of the books weigh 12 pounds. you do a radio show. Is it weekly?
Right. I do a weekly radio show on NPR, right.
Okay. Then you do television.
I do television on PBS. I'm in 350 markets across the United States on PBS. In fact, I'm in Pennsylvania right now. And how do I know that? Because I get people calling me and sending me emails from Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
so I know they're watching it either out of Philly or.
Yeah.
I've been very lucky in that my national television show on PBS has been on since 1989. My NPR show, Stirring It Up with Chef John Fultz, is heard regionally now, but it streams live on the web every week on jfultz.com. Just jfultz.com. If you click on Stirring It Up, you can listen to my NPR show. And then, of course, I have a local CBS affiliate show that airs to about 250,000 households every Tuesday and Thursday, where we talk about food as well. And my radio show is interesting in that I operate my show out of my own studio, but it's a kitchen. So I have a stove and all of that. I must show you my studio because I think y'all would enjoy it. But to have a food manufacturing plant, a restaurant, to have a catering division, to have a bakery division, a cheese division, to have the food manufacturing bringing food globally from Louisiana with Louisiana labor and great fresh products, and then ultimately have the media side between the cookbooks, the radio, and television, we're some lucky folks, let me tell you.
Yeah, but I hear you don't sleep.
That's not true. Let me tell you, when my head hits the pillow, I sleep. Nothing can keep me awake. I don't sleep long. 5-6 hours is plenty. But
well, anyhow, we could go on, of course, John. I'm looking forward now to have a tour of the plant facilities and to see your kitchen office or studio. And thank you for all your hospitality. Listeners, you have to get here. It's worth the trip.
JFultz.com. If you just go to www.jfultz.com, that's FOLSE.com, it has all of my companies listed. You can tour White Oak, Bittersweet, the Cheese Company, everything. And you can also have a company store there as well for books if anybody's interested in our books. And I'll be calling you because we have a new book coming out for the fall, and I'll talk to you about that later.
I'm looking forward to it.
You'll get your copy. Huh?
Oh, John, thank you.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here in Louisiana.
I'm going to go for a run to get rid of that breakfast.
There's more coming tomorrow.
Bye-bye. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We encourage you to email us on the menu at onthemenuradio.com or come blog with us on themenu.blogspot.com.
No, well, you got it wrong a different way this time. It's
onthemenuradio.blogspot.com,
assuming that you're interested in what we're putting up there and you want to add your own thoughts about the whole world of
food, wine
and dining, traveling, all that kind of good stuff.
Lifestyle, good things.
So we had to get a blog because Ann said we have a blog, so we have a blog. So we want you to be a part of it.
Anyhow, we're going to talk a little bit to somebody who knows probably more about American cheeses than anybody else I've ever met. His name is Clark Wolf, and he's going to take us on a little jaunt through artisanal cheese making in the United States.
Talking about a book that contains a lot of his accumulated knowledge that if you're an American cheese fan, you'll want to have. So here's Clark.
Clark Wolf you dedicated this book that you wrote, The Guide to American Cheeses, to your parents. Well, I think you should give them credit for the fact that they gave you a memorable name.
Well, thank you. I was actually named for my mother's mother, who died when she was two. Her name was Clara. And I'm really glad that they picked a immigrant American name like Clark, you know, because what kind of Romanian Jew is Clark Edward Wolf, right? It looks good in print.
Anyhow, the title of this book, which is delightful, is American Cheeses, The Best Regional, Artisan, and Farmhouse Cheeses, Who Makes Them and Where to Find Them. Now, that's a mouthful right there. You took a long time to publish this book. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, sure. I started in cheese in 1976 at the base of Nob Hill in San Francisco. And I saw a sign in the window, and it said, Manager Wanted for Cheese and Wine Shop, and I thought that would be fun. I opened the store for these people who hired me, and the second week of my employment, they went Chapter 11.
Oh, nice.
So I learned the hard way what a business does and doesn't need, and how powerful food in a community can be. I mean, that store, even though they eventually went bankrupt, the store got sold, et cetera, that store stayed a cheese and wine shop for 20 years, was an antique store for about 2 years, and is back to being a food and wine shop because there's something so powerful about sharing food across the counter with people. So for me, I learned about how to learn about food with cheese. And I fell in love with the stories, the histories, the fact that it was perishable and ephemeral and magical, but not as perishable, let's just say, as raw fish or as other kinds of gentle fresh foods. And there was so much connective history. But in those days, there were very, very few American-made cheeses that you could be proud of. I mean, there were some four-year-old Wisconsin cheddars. There was some Vermont and New York cheddar. There was Dry Jack from California, which really had been created between wars and during wars because there wasn't any import of Parmesan for the Italian community. So they kind of at first found something that was a mistake, dried up in a corner of a warehouse, and then ended up making it. And now it's made many years later still, but rubbed in a combination of vegetable oil, black pepper, and cocoa powder, and is a very unique American original. So there were a few, but not many. And then I got to be the cheese department manager and ultimately the managing director of something called the Oakville Grocery. It was a little country store on Highway 29 across from the Robert Mondavi Winery, where Bob and Margaret Mondavi were bringing great chefs from all over the world to do cooking classes for very wealthy people. And here we were with this little general store that had the post office as part of it and the whole routine, selling pretzels and beer and potato chips and whatnot to migrant farm workers and extra virgin olive oil and jars of black truffles and who knows what else to these famous chefs.
Wonderful.
So I helped work on that store, and then we opened kind of a fantasy grocery store in San Francisco in 1980 called the Oakville Grocery San Francisco, and we had cream top milk in bottles. I brought arugula to California, for which I've apologized several times.
Yeah, exactly.
and we did, there was no fresh mozzarella being made in California at the time, 1980. It was all hard blocks of nasty rubber. Mm-hmm. So I got the people at a Brooklyn mozzarella company, Polio, to send me a frozen block of curd, with which I began to experiment and make some really bad fresh mozzarella.
you write about that in the book.
yes, and at the same time, there was this magical woman in Santa Rosa, California, which is near where I have a cabin in the Redwoods, in wine country, northwestern Sonoma County. Who was her family had a turkey farm, and so they had a turkey restaurant. That's what farmers do. You know, you got some, you sell it, right? And she fell in love with goats and went to France and learned how and came back and made the first really good and really successful American fresh goat cheese, Laura Chanel Chev.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it kind of started, I don't know, an explosion. And over the last 30 or so years, it really has grown to be not just a world-class offering in terms of the collection of American-made cheeses, but a world-class community. So it took me a long time for a couple of reasons. One is I was kind of busy. You know, I'm a restaurant and food business consultant, and this is something I did betwixt and between.
Right.
And the other thing is that it really needed to come at the right time.
Exactly.
I actually, we're talking now in December of 2008. In January of this coming year, it will be 3 years since I turned the book in. Welcome to the world of publishing.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
They held it for 2 years, and then suddenly they said, okay, ready, set, go. I want you to update it. And delightfully, I wanted to include people who were benchmark in some way, not just the newest or the most obscure or the most esoteric. That's not what this is about. This is about good American made. And so I wanted people to be in business for 4 or 5 years at least, and I wanted to feel like they were going to be in business for a while. And sure enough, after this two-year hiatus, every single one of the people I wrote about was still in business except for one, and we left it in the book as a cautionary tale about what could happen. And
which one's that now?
I have to tell you that it's really kind of a good thing to learn about.
It's gratifying to have them all still hanging in there, huh?
Well, what's great is so here's how the book is done. I wanted to do a book in the form of a Kraft cheese book, which means if you wanted to learn about cheese and wanted to use American-made cheeses to do it, you could have this book. So the first bunch of sections is a series of short sections that are about how cheese is made, what kind of food it is, how to wrap it, how to store it, what to pair it with. All those things you kind of want to know. And then the book is divided into four regions, and they're kind of broad regions because we certainly are not advanced enough the way Europe might be to have micro regions or smaller, really distinctive regions. They're big regions. And at the end of each section of profiles in the region, there's a kind of a collection of other things to look for in that area, and then there's about 10 recipes. We have about 10 recipes from each region from chefs and cooks who are much more talented than I, giving us kind of benchmark recipes, a fondue recipe, a baked goat cheese and mescaline salad recipe. But I will admit, there are four macaroni and cheese recipes, one from each region.
Okay, you just happen to like that.
Well, I think, you know, we seem to be re-entering the macaroni and cheese economy, don't we?
Well, I guess we are, but I don't know that you could have foreseen that when you wrote the book.
Well, you know, in these cycles, you could always count on that. But it's also because macaroni and cheese is a beloved American food. And I grew up really not like, because bless my mother's heart, she was a very talented concert pianist, but a really frightening cook.
Like Peter's mother.
My mother was a frightening cook, but she never would have done anything nearly as radical as macaroni.
Oh, what did she cook?
She's English.
She boiled whatever it was very dead.
Yes, indeed. Well, my mother is actually from Moldova, from Chisinau, Central Eastern Europe. And yeah, I was nearly 20 years old before I found out that zucchini wasn't dark brown. So my epiphanous experiences were in Northern California after I moved out from Southern California. But I had some really good background. My grandparents were always living in places like La Crescenta, in a house backed by vineyards and in the Hollywood Hills. And my grandfather was a wonderful gardener. He would grow grapevines and tomatoes and peach trees and whatever there was. If there was a slip of earth, my grandfather grew magic. And my grandmother always had fresh cheese, big curd fresh cheese, on the table in a bowl, breakfast and lunch, always without fail. Never saw a tomato or a cantaloupe in the refrigerator. They knew how to take care of it.
Now, I have a question for you. You tell the story. I couldn't tell really whether you were are able to understand why this revolution in American cheesemaking. Was it just one and then two and then three and then everybody sort of got in on the act, or was there some fundamental causative factor that...
Well, I think it would probably go around the whole food.
Well, I think it was a combination of things. That's a wonderful question, and I don't seek to answer it. I certainly do pose it in the book, but I don't seek to answer it. But I'm really delighted that you saw that hanging there. It was a kind of coming of age. We were in love with Europe, and we traveled a bit, and, you know, all of us in the 70s, and wanted to feel more, I don't know, international and European. And I think it was somewhat of a combination of a rejection of the post-war industrialization that, as you know, has come to produce some really terrible food and some really non-food that is expensive and that gives us bad health and all the rest of it. So some of it was back to the landers, people just wanting to go back to a different life. And if you notice, a lot of the leaders are women. And that's because women and goats were undervalued.
Yeah.
And so
they
kind of quietly went off and did something delicious and useful. Huh. And it's come to fruition over a period of time with a lot of different factors. If you've read a wonderful book called The United States of Arugula.
Yes, I was just going to say it parallels the whole revolution and evolution of American cuisine.
Well, and make no mistake, it was in Northern California, and Laura Chanel sold her goat cheese to a woman called Alice Waters at Chez Panisse.
Yes.
And there has been a huge impact from all of this. But it's a combination of a lot of things. And what also happened is these new young people met some of the more traditional multi-generational families, like Ig Vella in Sonoma County.
Oh, yeah. Now, he's really special,
now, are these the Rogue River guys?
Right. Well, he's a combination. His dad, actually, Tom, actually founded the Rogue River Cheese Company.
He smuggled the actual bacteria out of France.
He did, and you know, these days smuggling bacteria could be pretty serious. and Ig's, Tom's son, kept it going up there until David Gremmels could get it and take it in hand and learn from Ig. And Ig still goes up there and gives classes in tasting and sensory evaluation. You know, these are things that really are the core essence of life. It turns out, and we've felt this, some of us, for many years, there's nothing more important than food. All these wars, all this economic whatever, it's all about getting something good to eat and being someplace warm and safe with people you love.
John Fals was the one who intrigued me probably the most, because what we talked to him about, the fact that he was getting into the cheese business when he was, and we said, why, John? I said, it seems such an unlikely place to make cheese. And he said, because I found out that back when France was involved in Louisiana, they made cheese.
Well, yes.
So I said, I knew they must be able to. That just seemed so unlikely.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have a funny little history. If there had been, and we don't know, any cheese at the first Thanksgiving, it was probably goats, because they probably traveled with goats on the boats. Jamestown, Virginia, is where the first cows came, Jersey cows. The Upper South, anyway, had really these dreamy, lovely Jersey cows and gorgeous milk, and Jersey tends to, I'm told, give higher protein, higher fat content.
Oh, yes, absolutely does, yes.
And you can't quite walk across it, but, you know, it's
pretty close.
Pretty delicious stuff. Anyway, sheep were often very popular in California with the Spanish, and, you know, if you know the history of the West Coast, the Spanish came up, and Father Huda Becerra just planted vines and missions and cheese making all the way up and down the coast. It's a long history, but it's a long history of a couple of hundred years, maybe a little bit more, not a long history like as it is in France, where Charlemagne, you know, liked the Roquefort and said, let's just make sure that we keep it the same way every time, and kind of created that kind of standard.
Now, can we talk a little bit about how listeners would use this book when they get their copy? You said you can sort of delve in almost anywhere and find some interesting information, but is there a way to use it to help you select the kind of cheese you might like?
Well, absolutely. I think, first of all, reading about the different families of cheeses and getting a general idea. You know, when I started in that little cheese shop, I knew a little bit about cheese from growing up and eating my mother's bad food, but also because I had lived in Berkeley, California, and went to a place called the Cheese Co-op, and you'd talk across the counter to a nice young person who would give you a taste. That's what this is all about, you know, starting somewhere with something you like and then trying something else and trying something else. So if you read a story and you read a little bit about this or that and how cheeses might be different and might be the way you want them to taste or to feel, then you can go from there and try things. I worked in this little cheese shop, and I was there for a couple of years, and then I kind of got it together to go to Europe, my first trip to Europe in the late 70s. And I went to a place outside of Paris called Rungis, which is the great international wholesale warehouse crossroads of a lot of European food. And I walked into two huge, I mean, airplane hangar-sized buildings. They were all filled with European cheeses, not just French, but from all over Europe. And really, even though I didn't know the little lady's name or the history or what kind of car they drove, I basically knew what kind of food, what kind of cheese I was looking at, no matter what I looked at. Because one of the nice things about cheese is once you get an idea of how it kind of all works, it makes a lot of basic physical sense. And I think that if people can learn a little bit and feel comfortable, you know, it's a really great way to learn more and get more comfortable with food in general.
So the real secret, in addition to having a copy of this book under your arm, is to go to a good cheese shop and say, let me try this, what would you suggest?
Absolutely.
I feel like today, what would go with this wine I'm planning to serve this evening? This kind of experience is very good.
That's the way to do it. That's how we learn about food. We look at it, we nibble, we sip. In fact, the first very introductory section is all about learning to taste. And I talked about how I learned to taste and how I think we all learn to taste. We, even before we touch or smell or put it in our mouths, unconsciously, through our eyes, we run it by our computer of everything we've ever eaten and everything we've ever sniffed near. And our body tells us, ooh, that's going to be good, or I'm not so sure about that. You have to start with the unconscious and let yourself be this physical person, this animal that you are, and then go from there and try it. That's the most important thing. You're talking about the wine. I do a section about how much I respect the people who balance and kind of track every single little piece and nuance of wine and cheese or wine and food pairings. I'm just not one of them. I really kind of think that that's not the way I want to spend my time for a couple of reasons. One, historically, people tend to have cheese at dinner anyway at the end of the meal, and that's not a moment when I want to think about new things. You know what I mean? You just kind of want to eat. A lot of times people just want to have some cheeses with whatever's left in the glass or the bottle of wine. And frankly, if you're going to have two or three cheeses or sometimes five little nibbles of cheese, one wine may not go perfectly with all of them, but you really don't need five wines to go with five cheeses at the end of a meal. The other thing that I thought was so interesting is just about when I was finishing the book, University of California at Davis came out with a study that basically verified what I had thought for a long time, which is that somewhere close to 80% of the nuance of a wonderfully built red wine disappears. Yeah. The minute you put cheese in your mouth.
Exactly.
I remember reading that and then wondering why is it that we put these things together and think that they go together so well, when in fact, in some respects, they really don't.
Well, exactly. I really encourage people. Well, certain white wines are wonderful. Certain sparkling wines are great with the richer cheeses. But actually, cider, beer, an apple, a pear, some walnuts, you know, dried fruits, those things are all really lovely. And if somebody's worked really hard to make a brilliant red wine, I kind of hate to coat my mouth in butterfat before I, toss it back.
Right.
Well, Clark, we could talk forever
about this. We
could talk to you all day.
I've been shout out. I was going to say, I can't believe you put this pimento cheese recipe in.
Well, pimento cheese. Yeah. I mean,
our son lives in the South, and I just absolutely was amazed.
Well,
I had my first taste of pimento cheese.
It's made with good cheddar. I mean, the point is that, we have all these recipes and all these foods that we kind of joke about because some of the ingredients have been so lowered that we can't believe that that's something you'd eat. But, the tradition of pimento cheese is darn good.
Well, that's a good note at which to say that not everyone will agree on which cheeses are the best. the good thing about it is that this book will encourage you to try cheeses that you never even knew existed, from names that you didn't ever know existed. And for that, Clay, the American cheese industry, or Clark, the American cheese industry should be grateful, and fans of cheese should be interested and should have a copy of this book. And thank you so much for joining us on the program.
It's wonderful to be with you.
Thanks, Clark.
Take care.
Bye. And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again. If you've been following our news items on our website at all, you'll notice that we announced these various festivals, and there are quite a lot of them. But there's an unusual one coming up for all you truffle lovers. You'll be pleased to know that the truffle growing in the United States is growing at a pace. No, I didn't mean that, grow and grow, but I guess I did. Anyway, if you're interested in learning about the Oregon truffle or about the festival, let's talk to our next guest.
Dr. Charles Lefebvre, you have a company called New World Truffier, which is the equivalent of a vineyard for truffles, right?
That's correct.
Now, how did you end up the truffle business in Oregon?
I started with a childhood fascination with mushrooms, but the business itself, I was a graduate student studying the American Matsutake mushroom, and somebody asked me to produce truffle trees for them.
When you say, going to explain what producing a truffle tree really means.
It means growing a plant under controlled conditions, an oak tree or a hazelnut tree, so that, let me back up a little bit. In nature, Every kind of tree you see has some kind of fungus on its roots that provides nutrients and water for the tree. The parts of the tree that absorb all of the nutrients and water from the soil actually are covered with this fungus that does all of that work for them. And truffles happen to be one of those fungi. So the truffles live in a beneficial symbiosis with the tree. The tree provides sugars that it produces through photosynthesis to the truffle, and the truffle provides nutrients to the tree.
Now, why is everyone in love with truffles? It's kind of it's an odd-smelling, odd-tasting thing, isn't it?
In a sense, it is. They are odd. Even the most expensive species have a very strange smell that some people love and some people hate. But one way to think about it is that, like an apple turns red to attract animals to eat it, truffles produce an aroma in order to attract animals. And this has to be a powerful aroma, one that's able to escape 6 inches of earth during the cold and the wet weather in the winter and still be powerful enough to attract the attention of some passing animal.
Which is why pigs used to be used and now dogs are mainly used to find truffles?
Well, the famous European truffles actually produce compounds that are known to act as pheromones for pigs.
Right.
So a pig actually doesn't require any training to look for truffles.
But they tend to eat them, don't they?
Exactly. They say that a truffle farmer who uses a pig doesn't tend to have all of his fingers. But whereas dogs, and there's also the problem that if you're walking your pig down the street in the south of France, everybody knows what you're doing. But then, of course, and pigs wear out, and they don't fit in those little French cars, and there are lots of problems with pigs. Dogs, of course, do have to be trained, which is a big project, but they can work all day. They're eager to please. They're less likely to bite your fingers off.
Yeah.
And they're less likely to eat the truffles, although they do sometimes.
I do. Now, there's such a big difference. I explained to you off-air that we've interviewed truffle foragers in Italy, in Le Marche, in Piemonte. We've interviewed truffle growers in Australia and in Tasmania, which is Australia, of course. But now the wild Oregon truffle, you have two things you're dealing with. One is the wild native Oregon truffle, and the other is the new farmed truffle, which is catching on actually all over the world. Tell us what the difference is. It's a different type, and I guess conditions are different.
With the native Oregon truffle, they're indigenous to the West Coast from San Francisco up through Vancouver, British Columbia. There are three different kinds that are harvested commercially. They are the winter white truffle, the spring white truffle, and the Oregon black truffle. They live under Douglas fir trees in acidic soils. And they live on farmland. They live in people's backyards. So they live kind of near where people do, which is actually something they have in common with French and Italian truffles. And obviously people have been working the land in France and Italy for thousands of years, and the truffles actually seem to benefit from that.
That's where, interesting, yeah.
And those French and Italian truffles, of course, live under oak trees and hazelnut trees in high pH basic soil. Their aromas are all very, very different from each other. The Oregon black truffle has a pineapple aroma, where the Italian white truffle has a powerful musk aroma that many people find offensive, and yet it's the most expensive food, one of the most expensive foods on it.
Right. And I mean, I said before that, and you did send the samples, I said before that I've never found that much flavor in Oregon truffles compared to the European variety, and you had some explanations for this.
Right. Part of the fact that when people began harvesting truffles here, we didn't have the history and the lore that goes with truffles in Europe. Part of that is the use of animals to find the truffle. When people began harvesting truffles here in Oregon, they used rakes to get them. And it's actually quite easy to find truffles just by raking up the forest floor. The trouble with that is that the truffles take 6 months to ripen or to mature in the soil. So like a tomato on your tomato plant, if you go look at your tomato plant in the middle of August, most of the tomatoes will be green, but you pick the red one. And that's what a truffle dog or a pig does. It sniffs around and ignores all the immature ones and just picks the one that's ready to eat. A rake, unfortunately, is unable to discriminate between those that are ready and those that are not. So the vast majority of Oregon truffles harvested with rakes are not ready to eat.
Huh. Well, but if you let them mature, you think that they are on a par with the European truffle in flavor?
Well, I won't. People have different opinions about which they prefer. And it's interesting when we've done blind taste tests that the results are all over the place. People prefer different truffles, and often the Oregon truffles win in a blind competition. But what really made me think that the Oregon truffles were undervalued was the fact that I work with the European truffles. I have them in my refrigerators in fairly large quantities.
And aren't you lucky?
But I also happen to live in Oregon where I can go out and harvest my own Oregon truffles. So I would often have them side by side in the refrigerator. And one of the hallmarks of good truffles is when you open the refrigerator, it fills the entire room with their aroma. But in that side-by-side comparison, often it was the aroma of the Oregon truffles that would dominate that.
So you just happened to get the right Oregon truffles.
Well, I had the luxury of harvesting enough that I could actually observe them through their life cycle from the time that they came out of the ground to the time that they rotted. And at some point in that process, each truffle kind of explodes with aroma. So where I might have 2 or 3 pounds of these truffles in my refrigerator, most of that aroma might only be coming from one of them.
Uh-huh. Well, it's fascinating. Now, you're having a truffle festival, right?
That's correct. At the end of January, January 30th, 31st, and February 1st.
And you have this every year? How often have you had this now?
This is our fourth annual Oregon Truffle Festival.
Yeah, and what happens there?
It's a variety of things. The intention from the beginning was to redeem the Oregon truffle. And for that, we needed to make it an educational event. But it can be an educational event by just giving people the experience of really great truffle. So we have a number of different educational seminars involved with growing the French and Italian truffle, the truffle cultivation seminar and growers forum. Then the rest of the festival is restaurant dinners, the grand truffle dinner with James Beard Award-winning chefs preparing the different courses of the meal.
Even dessert, I noted.
Yes, truffles are actually quite good in dessert, both white and black.
In like what, ice cream? Or
we've had ice cream a couple of times, had a number of truffle butterscotch, a number of different things.
Now, I was under the impression, or I had read, that one way of dealing with them, preserving truffles, since it's such a touchy thing with their, get them at the right moment before they go off, going rotten. And I'd read the best thing to do was make a compound butter and freeze it and then use it as you need it. And you told me that wasn't necessarily the case. You did tests on this.
I think freezing truffles, if you're going to lose them, freezing it is the best thing to do. But freezing truffles does change their aroma. It actually, a frozen truffle will produce different aromas than a fresh truffle will. So, for example, a frozen truffle will produce mushroom smell where fresh truffles don't. It's an interesting process. So
interesting.
It's a different experience than serving fresh truffles. Another way to make truffle butter is simply to put a stick of butter within its wrapper in a bag full of truffles. You can make truffle oil in much the same way. Just last night I was at an event where someone had a big jar of Oregon white truffles, and within that jar there was a carafe of olive oil. So the truffles and the oil are not touching each other, but the oil will absorb all of that aroma.
Wow.
So even if you intend to serve your truffles for dinner, you can still be flavoring butter with them.
Amazing.
If you're going to lose them, freezing them is definitely the best way to go. And you can compound them into butter and freeze that.
Now, the information on this festival is, we have it posted, actually, on our website.
Yeah, we do. There's a news item on our homepage. And you can probably quote the website anyway, just in case anybody is just listening to the program instead of looking at the website, Charles.
It's OregonTruffleFestival.com.
That's simple enough.
That's really complicated.
And like, where do you think the truffle industry is going to go in this country?
I think this is one of those rare cases where we can see the future laid out in front of us. We can predict, I think, with some accuracy, that the truffle industry in Oregon and the rest of the United States will become something on par with the wine industry. We understand now how to cultivate truffles, how to grow them on farms. It can be done on a large scale. There are hundreds of farms established across the United States right now growing the French Perigord truffle. About 7 of them are in production. The best of them just passed the 100 pounds mark. They harvested 100 pounds in 1 year, and actually the season's still got two-thirds to go. So the farms are actually doing quite well.
But doesn't it take 10 years to see your truffles?
Exactly. A good farm should produce in 4 or 5 years.
Oh, that's good.
The first of my customers to begin production started in 5 years. By the 6th year, the truffle farm should be generating a positive cash flow, but it takes 10 or 12 years to reach full production.
I see. Well, listen, I have to admit, I'm absolutely mad for your mushrooms in Oregon, particularly, what is it I like?
Morels.
And nobody tells you where they find those either, the wild ones. I'm a morel fan.
actually join mushroom clubs here and go on morel hunts and find them in great abundance.
Yeah, well, there are plenty of them, and I love them. Well, thank you for a short course on truffle growing, Charles, and it's fascinating.
And we hope you'll have a wonderful festival.
Thank you very much, and I'm sure we will.
Yeah, we might come next year, too. Okay, Charles, thank you. Bye.
Time flies when you're having fun, they say. It's hard to believe, but we're at the end of another program of On the Menu Radio. So we hope you'll join us again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.